You can stay standing. If you've already sat down, I'm sorry. Stand back up. But stay standing. We're in Proverbs chapter 6, and we're going to stand for the reading of God's word. Proverbs chapter 6, beginning in verse 6. Go to the ant, O sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief, officer, or ruler, she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber, and want like an armed man. And this is the word of the Lord. You may grab a seat. I love the Proverbs. Okay, I love the Proverbs. So poetic, so Shakespearean. Go to the ant, O sluggard. A couple years ago in our home group, someone got sick or something. We were writing a card, his get well card, and passed around for everyone to sign. Said, hey, put some scriptures in there. And one of the little kids, like a third grader of one of the parents in our home group, wrote in the card, look to the ant, O sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Get well. You know, Proverbs 6:6. And so as I came to teach, I was so excited that I got to preach on this passage. But we're in the Proverbs. I love them. We're starting a brief interlude. We've been in Romans for a long time. We just did 1 week last week on Christianity and Islam. We're going to get back to Romans in September. But for the next 5 weeks, we're going to spend some time in the Proverbs. We're going to try to get wisdom. And we may ask, you know, what are the Proverbs? What are we going to see? What do we find here? Well, the Proverbs offer us biblical wisdom as they give us a window into the world created by God. Listen to Solomon's words introducing this collection. This is Proverbs chapter 1, starting in verse 2. He says, the purpose of these Proverbs are to help the reader to know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing, in righteousness, justice, and equity. And then he gives us the overarching principle that will frame everything that follows in verse 7. Chapter 1, verse 7, he says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. These Proverbs offer us wisdom that originates not just in life experience, but in God himself. And so the Spanish author Cervantes said that a proverb is a short sentence about a long experience. And he's commenting on kind of proverbs of the world. And that's true of you know, maybe little sayings we may come up with culturally. But when it comes to biblical wisdom, when it comes to the Proverbs we find here, it's more than just life experience. This wisdom originates in God. The wisdom gained from this book helps us to navigate our relationships and responsibilities as we follow God's ways for living in his created order and his moral universe. Again, what are these Proverbs? Are they, you know, the equivalent of Twitter wisdom, knowledge from God in 140 characters or less? No. Hopefully, Bruce Waltke writes this about the Proverbs. He says, these short, pithy sayings are generalizations about life and not atomized promises. God works through them to guide our thinking, but we must be careful not to dice the collection into a grab bag of fortune cookie inserts. No isolated proverb can be taken as expressing the whole truth. It must be nuanced by the broader context of the whole book. And we're going to see later how certain proverbs may seem contradictory, and it's in holding them in tension that we gain wisdom. So Proverbs is not intended to be a guidebook that we grab every time we face a new challenging situation in our life. It's not the WebMD of life situations. The book of Proverbs really is to be lived in rather than referenced when needed. As we live in it, we are trained in the art of living wisely, so that we can face every situation, whether or not it's found in this book or mentioned here, and we can know how to react in a wise way. As such, I'd invite you, in addition to whatever you are doing devotionally in your life, over the next 5 weeks, maybe the next 31 days, consider reading one chapter of Proverbs a day. There's 31 chapters. It's perfect. It'll get you through the next month. But spend some time living in this book, even as we study it together as a church. Well, what are we going to find as we approach the topic of work? What does Proverbs has to say? What does it have to say about work? Well, throughout the book of Proverbs, there are several contrasts, several pictures that the authors give us to contrast wisdom and folly. Okay, so there's the wise person and the foolish person. Maybe the most famous is wisdom personified, Lady Wisdom contrasted with Lady Folly or the adulterous woman. We see the wise son, the good friend, the bad friend, the wicked and the upright. And one contrast that shows up several places in the book is the diligent and the sluggard. 20 different times, 20 different places, these two are contrasted. Now, sometimes the fool is called the sluggard, sometimes the slothful, or sometimes the person with the slack hand. And again, the diligent worker is the wise, and the sluggard is foolish. We'll see in a second that it's obvious that the sluggard is foolish because he or she is lazy. But it's interesting how often the contrast is not just called the hard worker, but the diligent. Because the wise worker, the diligent, thinks about and is careful and thoughtful about his or her work. And that includes hard work, but it will also include other things, as we're going to see. This morning, we are going to look at the world Proverbs tells us about and what it means to be diligent workers in that world. So, are you ready to enter this world of the Proverbs and gain wisdom? Here we go. Here's what we're going to see. We should be diligent workers. We should work diligently because, number one, work has dignity, work has been damaged, and work is being redeemed. That's our outline for the morning. Let's dive in. Work has dignity. On average, we spend a third of our life, a third of our living hours at work. You know, assuming that we sleep close to 8 hours a night, sorry, parents of young children, but most of us, if we sleep 8 hours a night, then at least half of our waking hours are spent at work. That is a huge chunk of our lives. Yet many of us rarely think about how our faith should impact our work. I don't think any of us are trying to willfully displease God at work, but my guess is that neither do many of us often think about how to willfully please God at work. What does it mean to integrate faith and work? Furthermore, I think some of us have never considered what God's view of work is, such that we may have unintentionally bought into ideas that are less than Christian. For instance, we are at times tempted to think that work is a necessary evil, a product of the fall, that we have to bear with it until we can rest on the weekend or rest on vacation or rest in retirement or rest in heaven. And this is less than the truth. As we're about to see, work has dignity. Turn with me to chapter 8 in the book of Proverbs. In chapters 7 and 8, Solomon contrasts Lady Wisdom with Lady Folly, or the adulterous woman. Okay, Lady Wisdom is wisdom personified. Okay, look at jump down to verse 22 of chapter 8. Solomon writes, and this is Lady Wisdom talking, and she says, "The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old. Ages ago, I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth." The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work. Now, these verses and the verses that follow, first and foremost, they point to Yahweh, the Lord, creating a world with a moral order. Okay, these verses are about God's creation of the world with wisdom built into it. But there's a subtle side point that we shouldn't miss. We are told here, in concert with Genesis chapter 1, that Yahweh, the Lord, is a God who works. Let's keep reading and listen to all the work that he does. Verse 25, before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills I was brought forth, before he had made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep. When he made firm the skies above. When he established the fountains of the deep. When he assigned to the sea its limit so that the waters might not transgress his command. When he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was beside him like a master workman. And I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the children of man. This is huge. God, before the fall, worked. God is a worker. This is very different from the other creation accounts of the ancient peoples. The Babylonians, they saw creation as the byproduct of a war, a conflict between two gods. And so it wasn't the product of the work of a loving deity. The Greeks, they had a stages view of creation. And the Golden Age, the first stage of creation, envisioned the gods and man living together in perfect harmony, and nobody worked. It wasn't necessary. Because in the Greeks' mindset, work was for peasants. It was for the poor, for slaves, certainly not for kings, certainly not for rulers or for gods. You know, even our own day, our secular humanistic mythology or origin story conceives of the world coming together by blind forces careening together to produce life, and work arises as part of our desperate effort for survival. There's no dignity in our work, but not so in the Bible. And not so in the Proverbs. God works, and wise people, therefore, can be godly by understanding the dignity of our work as we try to be like our Creator. Adam and Eve were made in God's image. And as those who represented him, who imaged him to the world, they were told to subdue and fill the land, to cultivate what God had made, to continue God's work. And all of this took place before the fall. Work is not a byproduct of the fall. No, it was always a part of God's plan for the world. And if you remember our study about heaven, I think it was two falls ago, we talked about how work is going to be part of the new heavens, the new earth. It's part of the future. And we are called to the same task as Adam and Eve. To show the world what God is like by the way we live. We are his image bearers, and this includes our work. Work has dignity, and therefore it is filled with meaning and significance. So, Proverbs 13:4 says, "The soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing, while the soul of the diligent is richly supplied." The foolish person is marked by an unwillingness to work, and maybe this is because of outsized cravings that lead nowhere. But the diligent, who is willing to work, has their soul supplied. They experience a filling, the dignity that comes just from working. I've heard people of my generation bemoan what they think is work that's below them. Somehow it's not changing the world, or it's not bringing about world peace, and it's not simultaneously ending, you know, child starvation and human trafficking, and therefore it's not worthy of their efforts. Now, let me say, those are incredible things to work for, incredible goals, but even what the world would call menial tasks are dignified by the Bible, filled with meaning, as we begin to see that we can resemble God by working at them in a way that shows others what he is like. We cannot elevate some work as somehow better than other work. Even quote-unquote ministry, because the Bible will have none of it. Now let me pause for a second and speak to maybe some in the room who don't think of themselves as working. Okay, if you're retired, you are still at work. Whether it's a particular hobby, whether it's caring for, you know, grandkids some of the time, whether it's volunteering or serving in your church, whether it's doing the labor of prayer on behalf of others, there is dignity in your work. Moms, I know that there is tension, there is struggle at times between
working moms and stay-at-home moms, as if one of those is working and one isn't. And let me just say, both have dignity in their work. Students, you may be thinking that you're preparing, waiting to enter the working world. And let me tell you, what you are doing now is work. And your work has dignity. Understanding that our work has dignity and says something about God, this shapes the way that we work. The diligent worker, the wise worker, therefore, understanding that work has dignity, the diligent do good work. As those who understand they bear God's image to the world, not to mention as Christ's ambassadors, we better do good work. Let me say this as clearly as I can. We need to understand that we bring dishonor to God. We bring dishonor to his name through shoddy work. Any temptation to stick it to the man or to spite our employer or to just sit back and cruise control is a temptation to set aside the dignity of our work. Our work should be good work, excellent work, beautiful, skilled, high quality work, because we are image bearers. And so Proverbs 22 says, "Do you see a man skillful in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men. The diligent worker is skilled. He gives himself, she gives herself to the work to do beautiful, excellent, good work." But the diligent also work hard. Now, this is obvious from the contrast with the sluggard. We are not to be lazy. And so we read, "A slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. He who gathers in summer is a prudent son, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who brings shame." I love that image of the slack hand. Full confession, about a time I was foolish. When I was in high school, some friends and I, during the meet and greet time at our church, we all decided, hey, when it's time to shake people's hands, let's all give them, you know, the cold dead fish handshake. And so we all stood up and it's time to shake hands. We're like, hello. And you see people like shake your hand, like get kind of creeped out because who does that? And I loved it. It's the slack hand. Okay, don't apply the slack hand to your work and I guess creep people out that work with you. No, the point of this proverb is clear. Okay, wise people work and experience the payoff. The lazy fool experiences the shame of poverty. Let's keep rolling. "Like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is the sluggard to those who send him." Hey, the image is of a person sending a messenger or sending someone to work on their behalf, and it's horrible. The result is annoying, it's painful. How many of us know the annoyance, the pain of a lazy coworker or employee? The Proverbs say, don't be that guy. Don't be that girl. Let's keep rolling. Chapter 12, verse 24. "The hand of the diligent will rule, while the slothful will be put to forced labor." If you can rule yourself, if you can manage yourself, if you are diligent, often this will lead to rule. It will lead to managing others. Ironically, the hand that avoids any work ends up having to perform the most burdensome tasks. If you're lazy, the result, the wisdom of the proverb says, you know what? It's actually going to end up to be worse for you. You're going to have the hardest work. Chapter 18, "Whoever is slack in his work is a brother to him who destroys. To be lazy is akin to vandalism." Chapter 19, verse 24, "The sluggard buries his hand in the dish and will not even bring it back to his mouth." Okay, the image of this sarcastic proverb is just, it's so intense, but just this lazy person with their hand stuck in the food dish, and they're so sluggardly, they can't even bring it back to their mouth. It's kind of grotesque, but the image is powerful, okay? The sluggard starves in spite of opportunity set before them. They don't take advantage of what's there. And so we could say in summary, chapter 12, verse 11, "Whoever works his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows worthless pursuits lacks sense." The point of all of this collection, and there's many more in the Proverbs, the point of all of it is clear. Work hard. And so Jane Austen of Pride and Prejudice fame once said, "Christians should be up and doing something in the world. We should get to it. We should work." Well, finally, understanding the dignity of our work means we will do good work, we will work hard, and we will work honestly. As those who image God, we need to consider honesty in our work. We should be honest in our words. And so 21:6 says, the getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor and a snare of death. We may be tempted to shade the truth, to be dishonored, to be dishonest in order to protect our reputation. Maybe we've screwed up and we try to backpedal and make up for it with less than the truth with those we work with. Not only does that lack integrity, it dishonors God. The diligent are honest in their words, but they are also honest in their deeds. And so we read, a false balance is an abomination to the Lord, and a just weight is his delight. There's two more that say similar things. And these clearly show trading, business practices. In the ancient Near East, they used scales to measure out grain or oil or whatnot, and then would pay for it or use those measurements to trade. And it says, if you are dishonest, you're using a false balance. It's an abomination. It's akin to idolatry, to sexual immorality, to child sacrifice. And so we need to consider in our business deals and our transactions, are we being honest? Are we cheating our work with our time by spending too much time in things that aren't work? Are we cheating those that we're doing business with, either clients or employees, by the way that we work our deals? We need to consider the call to work honestly. This is even seen in real estate transactions. Do not move an ancient landmark or enter the fields of the fatherless, for their Redeemer is strong. He will plead their cause against you. Now, in the Proverbs, there is a deep connection between hard work and honest work. The image that the Proverbs paint says that if you acquire wealth, okay, the product of work, if you acquire wealth without working hard, it means you are acquiring it at the expense of others. Failure to work hard means, if you achieve wealth, it means you will inevitably exploit others. Co-workers, clients, employees, or employers in order to get that wealth. So in order to be honest, working hard goes hand in hand. Now, all of these proverbs, and there are many more, they teach that good, hard, honest work will, most of the time, produce wealth and protect against poverty. Look to the ant, O sluggard, okay? But we must remember, they are not generalizations, not isolated promises. They must be held in tension with the second truth that the diligent understand. And that is this. Work has been damaged. While many of the Proverbs generally teach that hard work pays off, other Proverbs are also honest about the reality that our world is fallen. Consider the tension between these two Proverbs. The blessing of the Lord makes rich, and he adds no sorrow with it. However, better is a poor man who walks in his integrity than a rich man who is crooked in his ways. The first suggests that the rich are rich because God has blessed them. And then the second suggests that, wait a second, there can be a rich person who achieved this through crooked ways. Tremper Longman comments on these two. He says, some proverbs invite the thought that wealth only comes to hardworking, righteous, and wise people, while others seem to say that evil people can be rich. There's tension here. And the Proverbs are honest about it. In the world, God's created order is set up such that generally hard work does lead to wealth and laziness to poverty. However, we damaged that moral order, including our work, through the fall and the introduction of sin. And therefore, everything has been tainted, including work and the wealth it produces. And the Proverbs reflect this. Think about the world that this next proverb describes. Better is a little with righteousness than great revenues with injustice. This says it's possible to be wise and righteous and still be poor. And it's possible to achieve great wealth through foolish injustice. Furthermore, the Proverbs teach that poverty can be the result of injustice and oppression. The fallow ground of the poor would yield much food, but it is swept away through injustice. Clearly, there is tension in the book of Proverbs. Some in our culture, some, you know, hardcore free market capitalists on the right, they want to blame the poor for their laziness. However, those, some hardcore folks on the left who want to regulate the heck out of everything, they want to only blame injustice and institutional sin. And Proverbs comes along and says, poverty comes from both. Work has been damaged. And because of this, work at times feels fruitless. It feels pointless, or it can feel frustrating. You know, we work and work and work, and we try to be productive, and we even invent new technologies that are supposed to help us work faster and more efficiently, and yet it's not working. We still have unmet goals. Life is supposed to be easier, and it feels like it's getting harder. Our work feels fruitless. As we have these unmet goals, these things that we can't achieve because our own sin or injustice has swept away the work of our efforts. 13:23, the fallow ground would yield much food, but it is swept away through injustice. It can feel fruitless. I remember talking to a friend's dad several years ago. And his son, my friend and I, were each going to spend some time serving in different parts of Africa, working with the poor. And I remember sitting down at the table with my friend's dad, and he lamented to me and thought what we were doing seemed like good but fruitless work. He told me of his grandfather who had spent 30 years in West Africa, in Liberia, as a medical missionary. And he had done good, honorable work for the poor. He built up this thriving hospital that cared for the poor. But after 30 years, a civil war broke out and the hospital was destroyed. All that work was swept away. And to my friend's dad, he didn't know how to make sense of that. It all seemed like a waste. Work can feel fruitless because work has been damaged. But work can also feel pointless. In that we can work hard and get everything that we're striving for and still feel unfulfilled. Karis and I like to watch this documentary series on Netflix called Chef's Table about all these really famous chefs who have these incredible restaurants. They're rated some of the top restaurants in the world. And we're watching this one about this chef named Dan Barber who has this fancy restaurant back east somewhere. And it's like number 3 in the world or some big deal. And it's all about sustainable farming, farm to table stuff. But towards the end of the documentary, he talks about how he's just a workaholic. And he lacks any balance in his life. And his family is suffering because he's working so hard. And there's this, in the documentary, I was kind of shocked. It had this real moment of vulnerability where he says this. He says, so why is it that I haven't figured out a formula? I think there's something there that is driving me. It also fulfills something in me that I need, apparently. There's one way to look at my life as really exemplary, in that there's 2 restaurants. But there is another way to look at it that is quite sad. A lot of this work is an attempt to fill a sadness or something I didn't have in my life that I wish I had. I'm filling a void. Are we doing a lot of this because we have this void in our life we're trying to make up for? Isn't our life one attempt to fill a void after another? I don't know if I'm succeeding or not, but I'm trying hard. Who knows where this stuff originates or where it ends? I don't know. There's a lifetime to work out there. He just struggles with the fact that he's working and it should be producing something and it's not getting there. He's achieved what he wants and yet there's a void. Here you have this famous chef who knows he's a workaholic and yet his soul is still craving something. Hard work has not paid off and it feels pointless. The wisdom that comes from the book of Proverbs holds in tension these 2 truths. The wise person, the diligent, both works hard but also acknowledges the reality of sin in a broken world. And so I think the wise response to this tension is twofold. First, the diligent, the wise, just acknowledge this. They accept frustration in their work. On the one hand, I think the wise worker will expect to be regularly frustrated in their work, even though they may be in exactly the right vocation. You could be exactly where God has called you and still experience frustration in your work. Again, 13:23, the fallow ground would yield much food, but it is swept away through injustice. The wise, diligent worker understands that work can be frustrating. The diligent worker knows there will be times when we are frustrated in our work, and it's because the world is fallen. And yet, we do not throw up our hands and resign to being the sluggard. Now, on the other hand, I think this tension should shape the way we work. I think acknowledging this tension should lead us to be generous towards others in our work. And the Proverbs say this very thing. A righteous man, ESV says, knows, a better translation would probably be, cares about the rights of the poor. A wicked man does not understand such knowledge. This is also seen in chapter 31, when we're told about the virtuous or the valiant woman. We're going to study this whole chapter, I think, next week. But look at the connection, chapter 31, between work and generosity. Verses 19 and 20, this is the virtuous woman. She puts her hands to the distaff, that's part of a weaving tool, and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. There's a connection in this virtuous woman between what she does with her hands. On the one hand, she's willing to get to work. And on the other hand, she's willing to open her hands to the needy, to the poor around her. An awareness of this tension shows that we have a need to work hard. And yet, there's awareness of the fallen world. And this should compel us to generosity. We can be generous with our time when it comes to our coworkers or employees. We can be generous when it comes to who gets credit for things at work and not demand recognition. We can be generous with the produce of our work by giving of our wealth to the poor. The reality of injustice in the world, the acknowledgement that work has been damaged, should lead us to work with compassion and generosity. So work has dignity, but work has been damaged. And finally, work is being redeemed. How can we work hard when we know that work has been damaged? How can we work diligently when we know it is at times fruitless, frustrating, pointless? How can we be generous in our work without fear that we will lose out in the end? Chapter 16, verse 3. Commit your work to the Lord, and your plans will be established. Give your work to God. Consider yourself as working for Him, and your plans will be established. How can we commit our work to the Lord? We can only do all of this when we look and rely on the one who worked for us. Christ is called the wisdom of God in 1 Corinthians. You know, Proverbs showed us wisdom personified, but Christ was wisdom incarnate. Genesis says that we should work as those who are made in the image of God, but in Colossians we learn that Christ is the image of the invisible God. So here we have Christ, the ultimate wise image bearer. He is the diligent worker. And what did he do? He worked for us. He was generous, feeding the poor, healing the sick, giving us his body and his blood. He was honest. He was the truth. He taught, and he showed us what our sin deserved, but also how much we are loved by God that he would take it for us. He worked hard, laboring in prayer until drops of blood formed on his brow, standing in to be scourged and beaten, carrying the cross up the mount and receiving the wrath of God poured out on him. And he did good work. In fact, we're told in John chapter 5 and 10 that it was the works of his Father that he was sent to accomplish. And when he was done, he cried out, "It is finished." Jesus worked for us. It's from Tim Keller. When the extent and depth of Jesus' passion for you fully dawns on your heart, it will generate passion for the work he has called you uniquely to do in the world. You are adopted into God's family, so you already have your affirmation. You are justified in God's sight, so you have nothing to prove. You have been saved through a dying sacrifice, so you are free to be a living one. You are loved ceaselessly, so you can work tirelessly in response to a quiet inner fullness. The wise worker is called the diligent. He or she is careful, thoughtful, attentive. When you care about what Jesus has done for you, when you attend to his sacrifice on your behalf, when you fill your thoughts with his love for you, it will empower you to be the diligent worker you've been called to be. Each week, we come and take a meal to do just this. We attend to what he has done. We remember by taking the bread and the wine, the meal he has laid out for us, which represents his body and his blood given for us. We eat and drink of this meal to proclaim the Lord's death and to receive his work on our behalf. If you have placed your faith in this Christ and trust in his work for your salvation, I invite you to come. Confess your sins and again receive from the Lord all he has done for you. If you're not yet there, just watch a people who are working because Christ worked for us. Prayer teams will be available on the right and the left. Let's come to the table.